Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are getting into some really classic physical metallurgy. We're looking at a fundamental physical change in materials known as a phase transformation.
And this isn't just any transformation. We're zeroing in on the Martensitic transformation, which is a type of atomic shuffle that's, well, it's often described as military in its character.
Military. That sounds pretty intense.
It is. That language is used because it involves this highly coordinated, very precise, shear-like motion of atoms. It's almost like you have a regiment of atoms all moving in perfect lockstep to shift the entire crystal structure.
Right, a very orderly process. But in certain really important alloys, things like the iron-nickel systems you find in high-strength steels, that orderly process can go completely haywire.
It really can. It doesn't happen gradually, you know, atom by atom.
No, it happens in these huge, sudden, transformative bursts.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking up to 75% of the material changing its phase in, what, the time it takes to blink?
Less than that. This phenomenon is a kind of self-accelerating propagation, or as it's known, autocatalysis.
Autocatalysis. So it's a self-fueling reaction.
Exactly. The material starts to change, and that change itself provides the energy needed to force the rest of the material to follow along instantly. It's basically a runaway reaction, but it's all contained within a solid piece of metal.
And our mission for this deep dive is built around a really foundational 1977 Doctor of Science thesis by Gerald Albert Nurofsky, supervised by the legendary material scientist Morris Cohen.
It was a critical piece of detective work. They didn't just want to describe this burst transformation.
They wanted to measure it, to quantitatively measure the exact energetic assist that one tiny brand new martensite plate gives to spark the very next one.
And that's what we're digging into. The details of the experiment to figure out precisely how much energy one plate loans its neighbor to keep this incredible chain reaction going. You're going to uncover some truly ingenious experimental methods they used, especially with material gradients, and see how this work really settled a long-standing debate about the physics of how these transformations even start.
Okay, so let's ground ourselves in the basic physics here. Section one, the phenomenon of burst transformation. If we want to know how much energy is transferred, we first need to understand what is being transferred.
Right. So when that parent phase, which is called austenite, transforms into a new little plate of martensite, the area right around it feels an immense amount of pressure.
Because the new plate is a slightly different shape, a different volume.
Exactly. It's pushing against the surrounding material. And this results in two types of stress building up in that adjacent matrix. You have elastic deformation and you have plastic deformation.
And elastic is the one that's reversible, right? Like stretching a rubber band, the material wants to snap back.
Correct. But plastic deformation, that's the permanent change. The material yields. When the stress gets high enough, the atomic planes next door, they permanently slip and distort.
And that's where you get defects, like dislocations.
That's right. And this stored strain energy from both that elastic stretching and the permanent plastic deformation, that is the engine of autocatalysis. It gets transferred into the surrounding matrix, and it provides the energy boost needed to trigger the next plate at a nearby nucleation site.
So the formation of these successive generations of plates is what gives you that massive rapid burst behavior.
Absolutely. Without this cooperative energy transfer, the transformation would just be slow and, frankly, incomplete.
Which brings us to the core intellectual puzzle that Nurofsky and Cohen were tackling. If this strain energy is the assist, what is that energy actually doing?
And there were two major competing theories at the time.
The first one was simpler, right? The idea of stress-assisted activation.
Yes. That hypothesis just suggests that the stress field simply triggers weak, pre-existing nucleation sites. You know, little defects or impurities that are already in the alloy, it just nudges them over their energy barrier.
But the second idea was much deeper. It leaned on this concept of plastic accommodation. Are we saying the strain from that first plate actively creates brand new, more powerful nucleation sites?
That's the question. Is the material just finding a crack to exploit, or is the material actually engineering the perfect structural flaw to keep the transformation going?
And the only way to settle that kind of theoretical battle was to get some hard, quantifiable numbers. And that leads us right into the heart of this work, the methodology. I mean, how on earth do you measure an energy boost that happens on a microscopic scale in a fraction of a millisecond?
You can't put a tiny thermometer on it. You can't pause the action. It's too fast.
So what do they do?
Well, that's the brilliance of their approach. Nurofsky and Cohen realized that if they could quantify the required chemical driving force, the difference between the very first nucleation event And the very last one, where the burst stops.
That difference is the autocatalytic assist.
That's it, exactly.
Right.
They had to solve a time problem by turning it into a space problem. They couldn't pause the reaction, so they created a condition where the reaction had to progress slowly across a physical sample.
And they used these classic burst-type alloys, the iron-nickel systems that are known for this behavior. So the first technique they used was the temperature gradient.
Right. Picture this. They take a small rod of the alloy and they dip one end in something incredibly cold, like liquid nitrogen, while keeping the other end just a bit warmer. They created a deliberate thermal gradient across the sample.
Okay, so one end of the rod is cold, it's primed, it's ready to transform. The other end is a little too warm, so it needs a bigger thermodynamic push.
Precisely. So they could monitor the start temperature of the burst, we'll call it MB, at the coldest point. Once that first plate forms, the energy assist from it tries to push the burst forward into the warmer regions.
But it can only go so far.
It can only propagate as far as the combined energy of the assist plus the existing thermal driving force will allow it to.
That is just... it's so elegant. They're using the sample as its own thermometer.
Yeah.
But they didn't stop there. They also used a composition gradient.
Which is even more clever. For some specimens, they carefully prepared the alloy so that the nickel concentration actually varied along its length. So maybe it's 29% nickel at one end and 34% at the other.
And since the transformation temperature is super sensitive to nickel content,
it meant the chemical readiness to transform changed smoothly along the sample. So they had two different quantifiable ways to map the driving force across the sample, temperature and composition.
And how did they actually see what was happening inside?
For that, they needed high-definition visual proof. That's where serial section metallography came in. They took single crystal samples, which are structurally simpler to analyze, and just repeatedly polished, etched, and photographed them.
Like a material scientist's CT scan.
That's a great way to put it. Slicing through a crystal, layer by layer, mapping the precise 3D geometry of how these plates were stacking up against each other. They were looking for specific geometric patterns, these cyclic autocatalytic motifs. And they found them.
Right, so now we get to the payoff. Section 3, the quantitative energy assist. After all that incredibly careful mapping and thermodynamics, what was the actual number? What was the value of this energy?
The key finding, after converting all their measured temperatures into thermodynamic values, was that the magnitude of the energetic assist required for autocatalysis was approximately 55 calories per mole.
55 calories per mole, or about 230 joules per mole.
That's right, in their iron-nickel single crystals.
Now, 55 calories per mole sounds tiny. I mean, almost negligible.
It does, until you put it in context. The total heat of the reaction, all the energy released when the phase change happens, is around 600 calories per mole. So this is, what, roughly 10% of the total energy budget being used as a boost.
It's a critical threshold.
It is. They found it reached a maximum of around 60, maybe 61 calmol in polycrystalline samples, which suggests the grain boundaries also play a small role. And by correlating their measured temperatures, the MB and the maximum growth temperature, with known thermodynamic equations, they could translate all of it into precise driving force values.
So we have the number, 55 calmol. But here's where the incredible speed of this reaction throws a wrench in the works. We said it's a burst-type reaction, which means it's nearly adiabatic.
And this is a hugely important detail. Because the transformation is so fast, we're talking microseconds, there is no time for the heat generated by the phase change to spread out into the cold sample.
It's like lighting a tiny match inside a grain of sand. The bulk of the sample might be at minus 150 Celsius, but right at the interface where the reaction is happening, the heat release is instantaneous and explosive.
Narosky's calculations suggested that the local, very transient temperature rise, the 8 T-rite at these renucleation sites, could be as high as 100 degrees Celsius.
A 100-degree spike.
Okay.
For a microsecond.
100 degrees. And that completely changes the thermodynamics. The temperature measured by a thermocouple might say the bulk is ready to transform, but that local heat spike actually works against the transformation. It means the material needs an even greater chemical driving force to overcome it.
So they had to factor that in to isolate the true minimum energetic assist that was coming just from the stress field itself. Okay, so armed with this refined number, this 55 calories per mole, they could finally go back and confront those two competing theories. This is section 4, testing the autocatalytic mechanisms.
Exactly. The 55 calmol value was plugged directly into the existing theoretical models, primarily the ones developed earlier by Olson and Cohen, which tried to predict how much energy a defect needs to transform.
So let's revisit the two possibilities. First, the simple model. The stress just nudges a weak, pre-existing flaw over its energy hill.
And second, the more complex model. The stress causes permanent plastic deformation, which in turn creates a brand new, much stronger flaw that's perfectly tuned for transformation.
And the number gave them a clean, definitive answer.
It did. The energetic value of 55 calories per mole is quantitatively not consistent with simply stressing pre-existing nuclei.
So the simple model was out.
It was. The material just requires too much energy for that simple mechanism to explain the speed and the scale of the burst. The plastic accommodation model won.
The strain energy isn't just shaking the tree. It's being used to permanently deform the lattice and build a better, stronger atomic trigger.
That is the core conclusion. And to put it in atomic terms, their calculations, based on the Olson-Cohen model, showed that to get that 55 comol assist, you need a nucleus with roughly 17.8 dislocations.
17.8. That specificity is amazing. And it's key because the older models, based on pre-existing flaws, only accounted for about 14 or 15 dislocations.
Right. So the initial plate must be causing enough plastic strain in the material next door to generate those extra 3 or 4 dislocations, effectively engineering a more potent defect to make sure the burst continues.
It's like the material is dynamically improving its own efficiency as it transforms.
It is. And this was all backed up by the metallography. Those complex geometric patterns they saw, the zigzag arrays and the perpendicular coupling motifs, they visually proved that the arrangement required new dislocations to be generated in the parent phase to form the next set of plates.
So after all that, what does this all mean? Our deep dive into Narovsky's work really confirms that autocatalysis is a measurable, powerful effect. It's what fundamentally drives these high-speed burst transformations. And we have the number around 55 calories per mole.
But the real insight, I think, is that this assist isn't passive. It's the active creation of these highly potent dislocation-based nucleation sites through plastic accommodation. The energy from the first change is literally spent on structurally preparing the material for the next change.
This work just rigorously links the atomic scale world of individual dislocations to the massive, immediate, macroscopic behavior of an industrial alloy. It's a real intellectual achievement, especially given the experimental challenges.
The genius of the approach was solving that time problem. How to study a reaction that's over in a flash by turning it into a spatial problem, using those precise temperature and composition gradients to physically map the progression of the process.
An incredibly elegant solution to an almost impossible experimental problem. And that leaves us with the final provocative thought for you to consider. Given how effectively this gradient-based thinking allowed them to map the energetic landscape of a rapid, thermally sensitive process, how else might we apply this philosophy? I mean, deliberately introducing physical gradients to explore other fast processes in material science, or maybe even in biological systems that are just too complex or too fast to study when they happen uniformly.
Think about all the processes we're currently missing, just because we can only ever measure the start and endpoints and none of the crucial steps in between.